relinquish his hold on Kate. The impending marriage set in motion a curious series of machinations as to where the young couple should reside. Still harboring the illusory hope that closer proximity to Lincoln would beget greater influence, Chase opened the discussion by suggesting that Kate and William take the house just as it is, and let me find a place suited to my purpose nearer the president's. He assured Sprague that he was not among those fathers who wish to retain the love and duty of daughters, even in larger measure that they are given to their husbands. On the contrary, he wrote, I want to have Katie honor and love you with an honor and love far exceeding any due to me. Kate, however, was not persuaded by such protestations. She thought her father would be lost without her daily devotions and her consummate grace in orchestrating his social life. Under her supervision, the parties at the Chase Mansion had become legendary. Probably no woman in American history has had as brilliant a social career, one journalist observed of Kate. Even the achievements of Dolly Madison pale into insignificance compared with her successes. Fanny Seward considered herself lucky to receive an invitation to one of Kate's parties. Scarcely a person there whom it was not a pleasure to meet, she bubbled. I don't know whether it was Miss Chase being so charming herself that made the party pass so pleasantly, but I think so sweet a presence must have lent a charm to the whole. Unwilling to abandon her role in forwarding Chase's dreams, Kate persuaded William that they should all reside under the same roof. Approaching her father, she insisted that both she and William desired a united household. Though Chase had undoubtedly longed for this very arrangement, he made a show of reluctantly abandoning his idea of taking a house or apartment near the president's to suit their wishes. Life is short and uncertain, and I am not willing to do anything which will grieve my children, he wrote. So I yield the point. They agreed that Chase would continue to pay the rent and the servants, while William would cover the food and entertainment, assume half the stable expenses, and renovate the house to suit the needs of both a senator and a cabinet official. Recognizing the delicate link which has so long united father and daughter, Sprague wisely decided to respect and honor their relationship. I am not afraid that the tenacious affection of a daughter will detract from that she owes to one she accepts for her life companion, he wrote Kate. I am not so silly as not to see and feel that it is a surer guarantee of more permanent and enduring love. While he bristled at the discovery that Kate allowed her father to read all of Sprague's letters to her, he was gratified by the praise his writing drew from the ever-critical Chase. Katie showed me yesterday your letters to her, Chase told William, and I cannot refrain from telling you how much they delighted me. Making no mention of misspellings or grammatical mistakes, as he usually did with Kate and Nettie, Chase assured Sprague that the manly affection breathed in them satisfied me that I had not given my daughter to one who did not fully appreciate her, or to whom she could not give the full wealth of her affections. For Chase, William's desire to assume as much of the pecuniary burden as possible was timely indeed. The engagement allowed him to divest himself of his financial ties to the Cook brothers, whose private loans and gifts had assisted him over the years. Recent months had brought mounting criticism over the virtual monopoly the Cooks enjoyed in the lucrative sale of treasury bonds, but Chase had not felt free to dispense with the arrangement. On June 1st, however, he informed J. Cook that his compensation for the sale of the bonds would henceforth be reduced. I have a duty to the country to perform, he sanctimoniously wrote, which forbids me to pay rates which will not be approved by all right-minded men. The following day he returned a check for $4,200 that he had received from Cook as profit on the sale of a stock that he had not paid for. In order to be able to render most efficient service to our country, it is essential for me to be right as well as seem right, and to seem right as well as be right. Late in July, Chase joined Kate and Nettie for a few days' vacation in Rhode Island, where Sprague had secured rooms near the shore at South Pier. With a carriage provided by Sprague and good dining in the resort hotels on Narragansett Bay, the hard-working secretary relaxed for the first time in months. Leaving the girls at the seashore, he returned to Washington on August 7th. Alone in the big house, he complained to Nettie that his only companion was their dog, Nellie, who comes to see me every evening after dinner and puts her nose up in my face in a sort of sympathetic way. A sullen irritability is evident in his letters to both girls that summer. He chastised Nettie for her somewhat ragged-looking letter, pointing out how much her carelessness pained him, and he reprimanded Kate for failing to inform him when she borrowed money for the vacation expenses. In his loneliness, Chase resumed a warm correspondence with Charlotte Eastman, the widow of a former congressman. Handsome and intelligent, she had enjoyed a sporadic friendship with Chase over the years. When the relationship had promised to develop into a romance, however, Kate had disapproved, going so far as to intercept her letters. Chase had been unwilling to defy his daughter. Now, in Kate's absence, the two wrote to each other again. With inviting detail, Mrs. Eastman described her house on the Massachusetts seashore. She evinced little hope that Chase would join her, however. She suspected that her letters gave him little satisfaction, as they can do but nothing to advance the object for which it seems to me you live for. Now, shall I be frank, and perhaps offend you and tell you I am jealous? And of whom and what? Of your ambition, and through that of yourself. For don't ambition make the worshipper the god of his own idolatry? What a sweet letter you have sent me, Chase replied from his desk at the Treasury. I have read and reread it. What a charming picture you draw of the old house. It made me half feel myself with you and quite wish to be. I am so sorry that you and Katie, one so dear to me as a friend and the other as a daughter, don't exactly gee. As for her remarks on his ambition, he acknowledged that he was, in fact, driven in ways that sometimes led him to neglect duties of friendship and charity. She should understand, however, that he would always try to direct my ambition to public ends and in honorable ways. It would amuse her to know, he concluded, how many times he had been interrupted while writing this letter, which he had to bring to a close in order to attend to the president. While the heat enervated most of official Washington, Lincoln thrived on the long days, the relative freedom from office seekers, and the lack of family interference with his work. "The tycoon is in fine whack," John Hay reported on August 7th. "I have rarely seen him more serene and busy. He is managing this war, the draft, foreign relations, and planning a reconstruction of the Union all at once. I never knew with what tyrannous authority he rules the cabinet till now. The most important things he decides, and there is no cavil. I am growing more and more firmly convinced that the good of the country absolutely demands that he should be kept where he is till this thing is over. There is no man in the country so wise, so gentle, and so firm. I believe the hand of God placed him where he is." With Mary out of town, Lincoln found John Hay a ready companion. Smart, energetic, and amusing, the 25-year-old Hay had become far more intimately connected to the president than his own eldest son. Their conversation moved easily from linguistics to Reconstruction, from Shakespeare to Artemus Ward. Hay had a good sense of humor, and according to William Stoddard, could tell a story better than most boys of his age. Stoddard long recalled an occasion when he and Nicolay were rocked with laughter at one of Hay's humorous tales. Hearing the noise, Lincoln came to the door. His feet had made no sound in coming over from his room, or our own racket had drowned any footfall, but here was the president. If the young secretaries feared that Lincoln would chastise them for the interruption, he quickly dissipated their concern. He sat down in a chair and demanded that Hay repeat his tale. When the story was done, down came the president's foot from across his knee with a heavy stamp on the floor, and out through the hall went an uproarious peal of fun. On Saturday, August 9th, Hay accompanied the president to Alexander Gardner's photo studio at the corner of 7th and D Streets. The pictures taken that day do not reflect what Hay characterized as the president's very good spirits. Rigidly posed, with one hand on a book and the other at his waist, Lincoln was forced to endure the lengthy process of the photograph, which almost invariably produced a grim, unsmiling portrait. Subjects would be required to sit absolutely still while the photographer removed the cap from the lens to expose the picture. "Don't move a muscle," the subject would be told, for the slightest twitch would blur the image. Moreover, since contrived grinning in photographs had not yet become obligatory, many faces, like Lincoln's, took on a melancholy cast. Lincoln retained his high spirits through much of the summer, buoyed by the thought that the rebel power is at last beginning to disintegrate. In his diary, Hay described a number of pleasant outings, including an evening journey to the observatory. They viewed the moon and the star Arcturus through a newly installed telescope before driving out to the soldiers' home, where Lincoln read Shakespeare to Hay. "The end of Henry VI and the beginning of Richard III, till my heavy eyelids caught his considerate notice and he sent me to bed." The route Lincoln traveled to and from the soldiers' home took him down Vermont Avenue, past the lodgings of Walt Whitman. "I see the president almost every day," Whitman wrote. "None of the artists or pictures has caught the deep, though subtle and indirect, expression of this man's face. There is something else there. One of the great portrait painters of two or three centuries ago is needed." Whitman proudly noted that, "We have got so that we exchange bows, and very cordial ones. Sometimes the president goes and comes in an open barouche. The cavalry always accompany him, with drawn sabers. Often I notice as he goes out evenings, and sometimes in the morning, when he returns early, he turns off and halts at the large and handsome residence of the Secretary of War on K Street." All summer, Stanton harbored hopes that he and Lincoln might escape to the mountains of Pennsylvania. "The president and I have been arranging to make a trip to Bedford," he told Ellen, "but something always turns up to keep him or me in Washington. He is so eager for it that I expect we shall accomplish it before the season is over." In fact, though Stanton finally joined his wife during the first week of September, Lincoln journeyed no farther that summer than the soldiers' home. The president was rarely alone, however. In addition to Hay and Stanton, he could rely on Seward for good companionship. John Hay witnessed a typically wide-ranging conversation between them as the three rode to the Capitol on August 13th to view a sculptural work, The Progress of Civilization, recently installed in the eastern pediment of the north wing of the Capitol. The conversation opened on the topic of slavery, slipped back to the time of the Masons and anti-Masons, then turned to the Mexican War. Both Seward and Lincoln agreed that one fundamental principle of politics is to be always on the side of your country in a war. It kills any party to oppose a war. As indeed Lincoln knew from his own experience in opposing the Mexican War. The following day, Seward left for a two-week tour of upstate New York with foreign ministers, including those from England, France, Spain, Germany, and Russia. Seward had engineered the trip to counter the impression abroad that the lengthy war was starting to exhaust the resources of the North. With Seward as their guide, members of the diplomatic corps journeyed up the Hudson, stopping in Albany, Schenectady, and Cooperstown. They sailed on the Finger Lakes, visited Niagara Falls, and spent the night in Auburn, where they were joined by Seward's neighbors and friends for a picnic on the lake. All seemed to be enjoying themselves very much, Francis noted. Seward, extroverted, as always, provided a sparkling commentary, excellent food, abundant drink, and good cheer. After months of tense wrangling over the status of the Confederacy, the European ministers saw a different side of Seward and enjoyed his easy camaraderie. "When one comes really to know him," Lord Lyons reported to Lord Russell, "one is surprised to find much to esteem and even to like in him." More important, the tour allowed the skeptical ministers to witness the boundless resources of the North. "Hundreds of factories with whirring wheels," Fred Seward wrote, "thousands of acres of golden harvest fields, miles of railway trains laden with freight, busy fleets on rivers, lakes, and canals, all presaged the inevitable triumph of the Union." This clear perception of the Union's strength contributed to the successful resolution of a troubling controversy with Great Britain and France. Since the previous autumn, the administration had been bedeviled by knowledge that the Confederacy had contracts with European shipbuilders for armored vessels vastly superior to anything in the Union fleet. For months, Seward had coupled diplomatic efforts with strident warnings of war should the ironclads leave Europe. Not until September, several weeks after the diplomatic tour, did he receive trustworthy assurances from the governments of England and France that the rams would not be delivered. With Seward in upstate New York, Stanton in the mountains of Pennsylvania, Nicolay out west, and Hay setting out for a week's vacation in Long Branch, New Jersey, Lincoln was left in relative solitude. "The White House," Stoddard noted, "is deserted, save by our faithful and untiring chief magistrate, who alone of all our public men is always at his post." Notwithstanding, Stoddard observed, "He looks less careworn and emaciated than in the spring, as if, living only for his country, he found his own vigor keeping pace with the returning health of the nation." Chapter 21. I Feel Trouble in the Air. The summer of 1863 marked a crucial transformation in the Union war effort. The organization and deployment of black regiments that would eventually amount to 180,000 soldiers, a substantial proportion of eligible black males. The struggle to open the door for black recruits had finally ended when Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation flatly declared that blacks would be received into the armed service of the United States. 3 weeks later, Stanton authorized Massachusetts Governor John Andrew to raise 2 regiments of black troops. Since Massachusetts had only a small black population, Andrew called on Major George L. Stearns to head a recruitment effort that would reach into New York and other northern states. Stearns approached Frederick Douglass for help. Douglass was overjoyed. He had long believed that the war would not be won so long as the North refused to employ the black man's arm in suppressing the rebels. He wrote stirring appeals in his monthly magazine and traveled throughout the North, speaking at large meetings in Albany, Syracuse, Buffalo, Philadelphia, and many other cities, offering 12 answers to the question, "Why should a colored man enlist?" Nothing, he assured them, would more clearly legitimize their call for equal citizenship. "You will stand more erect, walk more assured, feel more at ease, and be less liable to insult than you ever were before. He who fights the battles of America may claim America as his country, and have that claim respected. The black soldiers who initially answered Douglas's call became part of the famed 54th Massachusetts Regiment, captained by Robert Gould Shaw, the son of wealthy Boston abolitionists. This first black regiment from the North included two of Frederick Douglass's own sons, Charles and Lewis. On May 28th, thousands of Bostonians poured into the streets, cheering the men as they marched past the State House and the Common. At a parade ground, they were reviewed by the governor and various high-ranking military officials. "No single regiment has attracted larger crowds," the Boston Daily Evening Transcript reported. "Ladies lined the balconies and windows of the houses, waving their handkerchiefs as the brass band led the proud regiment to the parade ground." Frederick Douglass attended the ceremonies, proudly extolling the manly bearing and admirable marching of the men he had worked hard to recruit. After bidding his sons farewell, he returned to the task of recruiting with renewed zeal. Lincoln was in full accord with this drive to build black regiments. Though he had initially resisted proposals to arm blacks, he was now totally dedicated. He urged Banks, Hunter, and Grant to speed the enlisting process, and implored Governor Andrew Johnson of Tennessee to raise black troops. "The colored population is the great available and yet unavailed of force for restoring the Union," Lincoln wrote. "The bare sight of 50,000 armed and drilled black soldiers on the banks of the Mississippi would end the rebellion at once." Chase, who had argued more strongly than any other cabinet member for black soldiers, took great satisfaction in Lincoln's newfound commitment. "The president is now thoroughly in earnest in this business," he wrote a friend, "and sees it much as I saw it nearly 2 years ago." In his efforts to recruit black soldiers, Douglass encountered a series of obstacles forged by white prejudice. Black soldiers received less pay than white soldiers, they were denied the enlistment bounty, and they were not allowed to be commissioned as officers. Still, Douglass insisted, "This is no time for hesitation. Once let the black man get upon his person the brass letters U.S. Let him get an eagle on his button and a musket on his shoulder and bullets in his pocket," he told a mass audience in Philadelphia, "and there is no power on the earth or under the earth which can deny that he has earned the right of citizenship in the United States. I say again, this is our chance, and woe betide us if we fail to embrace it." When the newly organized black troops went into battle at Port Hudson, Milliken's Bend, and Fort Wagner, they earned great respect from white soldiers and civilians alike for their bravery and steadiness. If captured, however, they ran the risk of losing their freedom or their lives, for the Confederate Congress had passed an ordinance dooming to death or slavery every Negro taken in arms and every white officer who commands Negro troops. As word of the unique dangers they faced spread through the black community, Douglass found that the size and enthusiasm of his audiences were swiftly diminishing, as was the number of black enlistments. He blamed Lincoln for not speaking out against the Confederate ordinance. "What has Mr. Lincoln to say about this slavery and murder? What has he said? Not one word. In the hearing of the nation, he is as silent as an oyster on the whole subject." The time for patience with the president had come and gone, he argued, "until he shall interpose his power to prevent these atrocious assassinations of Negro soldiers, the civilized world will hold him, equally with Jefferson Davis, responsible for them." Lincoln's failure to speak out and protect the Union's black soldiers convinced Douglas that he could no longer persuade men to enlist in good conscience. "When I plead for recruits, I want to do it with my heart, without qualification," he explained to Major Stearns. "I cannot do that now. The impression settles upon me that colored men have much overrated the enlightenment, justice, and generosity of our rulers at Washington." In fact, Lincoln was already formulating a response. During the last week of July 1863, he asked Halleck to prepare an order of retaliation, which was issued on July 30th. The order made clear that the law of nations and the usages and customs of war as carried on by civilized powers permit no distinction as to color in the treatment of prisoners of war. The Confederate ordinance represented a relapse into barbarism that required action on the part of the Union. It is therefore ordered that for every soldier of the United States killed in violation of the laws of war, a rebel soldier shall be executed, and for everyone enslaved by the enemy or sold into slavery, a rebel soldier shall be placed at hard labor. The order was well written, the antagonistic Count Gorofsky conceded, but like all Mr. Lincoln's acts, it is done almost too late, only when the poor president was so cornered by events that shifting and escape became impossible. Douglas agreed, but acknowledged that the president, being a man of action, might have been waiting for a case in which he should be required to act. Although the retaliatory order alleviated one major concern, Douglas feared that the lack of fair play in the handling of black enrollees would continue to hamper recruiting. Major Stearns suggested that Douglas should go to Washington and explain the situation to the president. Having never visited the nation's capital, Douglas experienced an inexpressible tumult of feeling when he entered the White House. "I could not know what kind of a reception would be accorded me. I might be told to go home and mind my business, or I might be refused an interview altogether." Finding a large crowd in the hallway, Douglas expected to wait hours before gaining an audience with the president. Minutes after presenting his card, however, he was called into the office. "I was never more quickly or more completely put at ease in the presence of a great man than in that of Abraham Lincoln," he later recalled. The president was seated in a chair when Douglas entered the room, surrounded by a multitude of books and papers. His feet and legs were extended in front of his chair. On my approach, he slowly drew his feet in from the different parts of the room into which they had strayed, and he began to rise. As Lincoln extended his hand in greeting, Douglas hesitantly began to introduce himself. "I know who you are, Mr. Douglas," Lincoln said. "Mr. Seward has told me all about you. Sit down. I am glad to see you." Lincoln's warmth put Douglas instantly at ease. Douglas later maintained that he had never seen a more transparent countenance. He could tell at a glance the justice of the popular estimate of the president's qualities expressed in the prefix "honest" to the name of Abraham Lincoln. Douglas laid before the president the discriminatory measures that were frustrating his recruiting efforts. "Mr. Lincoln listened with earnest attention and with very apparent sympathy," he recalled. "Upon my ceasing to speak, he proceeded with an earnestness and fluency of which I had not suspected him." Lincoln first recognized the indisputable justice of the demand for equal pay. When Congress passed the bill for black soldiers, he explained, it seemed a necessary concession to smooth the way to their employment at all as soldiers. But he promised that in the end they shall have the same pay as white soldiers. As for the absence of black officers, Lincoln assured Douglas that He would sign any commission to colored soldiers whom his Secretary of War should commend to him. Douglas was particularly impressed by Lincoln's justification for delaying the retaliatory order until the public mind was prepared for it. Had he acted earlier, Lincoln said, before the recent battles, in which Negroes had distinguished themselves for bravery and general good conduct, he was certain that such was the state of public popular prejudice, that an outcry would have been raised against the measure. It would be said, "Ah, we thought it would come to this. White men were to be killed for Negroes." In fact, he confessed to grave misgivings that, once begun, there was no telling where it would end, that if he could get hold of the Confederate soldiers who had been guilty of killing black prisoners, he could easily retaliate. But the thought of hanging men for a crime perpetrated by others was revolting to his feelings. While Douglas disagreed, believing the order essential, he respected the humane spirit that prompted Lincoln's concerns. Before they parted, Lincoln told Douglas that he had read a recent speech in which the fiery orator had lambasted the tardy, hesitating, and vacillating policy of the President of the United States. Though he conceded that he might move with frustrating deliberation on large issues, he disputed the accusation of vacillation. "I think it cannot be shown that when I have once taken a position, I have ever retreated from it." Douglas would never forget his first meeting with Lincoln, during which he felt as though I could put my hand on his shoulder. Later that same day, Douglas met with Stanton. "The manner of no two men could be more widely different," he observed. His first glance was that of a man who says, "Well, what do you want? I have no time to waste upon you or anybody else." Nonetheless, once Douglas began to outline much the same issues he had addressed with the President, contempt and suspicion and brusqueness had all disappeared from his face. And Stanton, too, promised that justice would ultimately be done. Indeed, Stanton had already implored Congress to remove the discriminatory wage and bounty provisions, which it would eventually do. Impressed by Douglas, Stanton promised to make him an assistant adjutant general assigned to Lorenzo Thomas, then charged with recruiting black soldiers in the Mississippi Valley. The War Department followed up with an offer of a $100 a month salary plus subsistence and transportation, but the commission was not included. Douglas declined. "I knew too much of camp life and the value of shoulder straps in the army to go into the service without some visible mark of my rank." Douglas and Lincoln had established a relationship that would prove important for both men in the weeks and months ahead. In subsequent speeches, Douglas frequently commented on his gracious reception at the White House. "Perhaps you may like to know how the President of the United States received a black man at the White House," he would say. "I will tell you how he received me, just as you have seen one gentleman receive another." As the crowd erupted into great applause, he continued, "I tell you, I felt big there." In the relative quiet that followed, Lincoln immersed himself in the task of composing another public letter. This letter was addressed to James Conkling, the old Springfield friend in whose office he had anxiously awaited news from Chicago during the Republican nominating convention. As a leading Illinois Republican, Conkling had invited Lincoln to attend a mass meeting in Springfield on September 3rd. Organized to rally loyal Unionists in a show of strength against the Copperhead influence, which remained strong in the Northwest. Union victories at Gettysburg and Vicksburg had created a deceptive feeling that peace was close at hand. False rumors circulated that Lincoln had received and rejected several viable peace proposals. It was essential to derail these damaging stories and halt Copperhead momentum in its tracks. While he doubtless would have been received with adoration in his hometown, Lincoln decided to remain in Washington and compose a comprehensive letter for Conkling to read at the meeting and then have printed for mass distribution. After completing an early draft, Lincoln searched out someone to listen as he read it aloud. It was a Sunday night, and the mansion was nearly vacant. Entering the library, the president was delighted to find William Stoddard.
"Ah, I'm glad you're here," Lincoln said. "Come over into my room."
Stoddard followed him into his office.
"Sit down," Lincoln urged. "What I want is an audience. Nothing sounds the same when there isn't anybody to hear it and find fault with it."
Stoddard expressed doubt that he would be inclined to criticize the president's words.
"Yes, you will," Lincoln good-humoredly replied. "Everybody else will. It's just what I want you to do."
Then, taking the sheets of foolscap paper from the end of the cabinet table on which he had been writing, he began to read. Warming to the task, Lincoln allowed his voice to rise and fall as if he were speaking to an audience of thousands. When he finished, he asked Stoddard's impression. Stoddard's sole objection was to fault Lincoln's metaphor, Uncle Sam's web feet, for the Navy gunboats that plied the rivers and bayous.
"I never saw a web-footed gunboat in all my life," Stoddard said. "They're a queer kind of duck," Lincoln laughed. "Some of 'em did get ashore, though. I'll leave it in, now I know how it's going to sound."
Then, thanking Stoddard, he bade him good night. The address was designed to curb the deceptive and groundless rumors that Lincoln had secretly rejected peace proposals. If any legitimate propositions should be received, he pledged, they would not be kept a secret from the people he was elected to serve.
"But, to be plain," he went on, "you are dissatisfied with me about the Negro. You dislike the Emancipation Proclamation, and perhaps would have it retracted."
On this point there would be no compromise. "It cannot be retracted, any more than the dead can be brought to life, for the promise being made must be kept." Furthermore, black soldiers had become so integral to the war effort that some of the commanders of our armies in the field, who have given us our most important successes, believe the emancipation policy and the use of colored troops constitute the heaviest blow yet dealt to the rebellion.
"Peace does not appear so distant as it did," Lincoln concluded. "And then there will be some black men who can remember that, with silent tongue and clenched teeth and steady eye and well-poised bayonet, they have helped mankind on to this great consummation, while I fear there will be some white ones unable to forget that, with malignant heart and deceitful speech, they have strove to hinder it."
Lincoln continued to refine his letter over the next 10 days, stealing what time he could from his public duties. He finally sent it, accompanied with a personal note to Conkling. "You are one of the best public readers. I have but one suggestion. Read it very slowly." An immense crowd was expected, drawn from the farm and the workshop, the local newspaper reported, from the office and the counting room, to prove to the Copperheads that behind the soldiers already in the field were hundreds of thousands more who are willing to offer their services whenever the country calls. Confident in his final composition, Lincoln anticipated a positive reception on September 3rd, when it would be read to the crowd and then given to newspapers for publication the following day. When he awoke on the morning of the mass meeting, however, he was furious to see a truncated version of his letter printed in the Washington Daily Chronicle. Lincoln immediately complained to the editor, John Forney.
"Don't blame us," Forney explained to Lincoln. "We got it from the Associated Press, and it's in daily newspapers across the country."
Provoked,
Lincoln telegraphed Conkling in Springfield. I am mortified this morning to find the letter to you botched up in the Eastern papers, telegraphed from Chicago. How did this happen? Hearing nothing that day from Conkling, Lincoln remained testy. When a petitioner tried to solicit his help in securing property for a Memphis woman whose husband was in the Confederate Army, the president uncharacteristically replied that he had neither the means nor time to consider the request, and that the impropriety of bringing such cases to me is obvious to anyone. The following morning, a message arrived from Conkling. Apparently, he had telegraphed the letter in advance with strict injunctions not to permit it to be published before the meeting or make any improper use of it. He was mortified that someone had broken faith, but trusted that no prejudicial results have been experienced, as the whole letter was published the next day. In fact, the publication of the entire letter received excellent reviews. Disclaiming the arts of the diplomatist, the cunning of the politician, and the graces of rhetoric, he comes straight to the points he wants to discuss, praised the New York Daily Tribune. The most consummate rhetorician never used language more pat to the purpose, the New York Times declared, and still there is not a word in the letter not familiar to the plainest plowman. While felicity of speech was usually linked to high culture, the Times continued, Lincoln, in his own independent and perhaps we might say very peculiar way, exhibits a felicity of speech far surpassing stylistic preference. He possesses a far more valuable felicity of thought, which invariably gets at the needed truth of the time, hitting the very nail of all others which needs driving. The Philadelphia Inquirer had regarded Lincoln's unconventional habit of writing public letters with skepticism, but granted that his recent letters, including this one, have dispelled the doubt. If he is as felicitous in the future, we hope he will continue to write. His last letter is a great thing, Hay told Nicolay a few days later. Some hideously bad rhetoric, some indecorums that are infamous, yet the whole letter takes its solid place in history as a great utterance of a great man. The whole cabinet could not have tinkered up a letter which could have been compared with it. He can snake a sophism out of its hole better than all the trained logicians of all schools. In its fulsome praise of the letter to Conkling, the New York Times also commended a long line of Lincoln's writings, including his inaugural, the letters to McClellan made public by the Congressional Committee on the Conduct of the War, and his published letters to Greeley and Corning, which revealed the same fitness to the occasion and the same effectiveness in its own direction. Taken together, these remarkable documents had made Lincoln the most popular man in the Republic. All the denunciations and all the arts of demagogues are perfectly powerless to wean the people from their faith in him. I know the people want him, Hay wrote to Nicolay, looking forward to the next election. There is no mistaking that fact, but politicians are strong yet, and he is not their kind of a cat. I hope God won't see fit to scourge us for our sins by any one of the two or three most prominent candidates on the ground. By the middle of September 1863, all the members of Lincoln's cabinet had returned from their summer sojourns. Seward came back invigorated by his trip through the Lake region with the diplomatic corps. Bates was back from Missouri in time to celebrate his 70th birthday, grateful that his long life had been crowned with many blessings and comparatively few crosses. He noted with pride that as a public figure he had achieved a reputation for knowledge and probity quite as good as I deserve. Stanton, too, had enjoyed a much-needed vacation with his family in the mountains of Pennsylvania. Chase, in characteristic fashion, had allowed himself scant respite from work, leaving his daughters at the seashore, and then peevishly awaiting their return. Wells was gratified to return from his 10-day visit to the Navy Yards, noting in his diary that all his colleagues seemed glad to see me, none more so than the President, who cordially and earnestly greeted me. I have been less absent than any other member, and was therefore perhaps more missed. Lincoln himself still enjoyed leisurely nights at the soldiers' home, and looked forward to Mary's homecoming from the Green Mountains. Grim news from Tennessee deflated the genial, relaxed mood of the President and his cabinet. After the victories at Gettysburg and Vicksburg, Lincoln and Stanton had hoped that General Rosecrans, with the Army of the Cumberland, could deliver the finishing blow to the rebellion. He was positioned to push the enemy from Chattanooga and Knoxville, Tennessee, with an eye to advancing on Georgia. However, after Rosecrans delivered a great and bloodless victory at Chattanooga, as the enemy fled from the city before advancing troops, the Confederates regrouped and unexpectedly appeared in force on the south bank of the Chickamauga. A furious battle commenced on Saturday, September 19th. Within 36 hours, the telegrams from the field indicated a stunning Confederate victory. "Chickamauga is as fatal a name in our history as Bull Run," Dana wired Stanton. Union casualties totaled 16,000 men. "We have met with a serious disaster," Rosecrans acknowledged. "Enemy overwhelmed us, drove our right, pierced our center, and scattered troops there." Lincoln told Wells that the dispatches reached him at the soldiers' home shortly after he got asleep, and so disturbed him that he had no more rest, but arose and came to the city and passed the remainder of the night awake and watchful. At daybreak, the President wandered into Hay's room, where, seated on the bed, he broke the news to his young aide. "Well, Rosecrans has been whipped, as I feared. I have feared it for several days. I believe I feel trouble in the air before it comes." Later that same day, perhaps hoping that the presence of his family might lift his spirits, Lincoln telegraphed Mary. "The air is so clear and cool, and apparently healthy, that I would be glad for you to come. Nothing very particular, but I would be glad to see you and Tad." Mary responded immediately, saying she was anxious to return home, and had already made plans to do so. As further reports filtered in, the fallout of the battle proved less unfavorable than was feared, a relieved Chase noted. General George Thomas's corps had held its ground, and the rebels had lost even more troops than the Federals. "Chattanooga still remains in our hands," Charles Dana wired to Stanton, "and, with reinforcements of 20,000 to 30,000 troops, can be held by this army for from 15 to 20 days. Without the additional troops, however, the outnumbered Federals would have to abandon Chattanooga or face another potentially disastrous battle. Everything hinged on whether this massive movement of troops would reach Tennessee in time. Shortly before midnight on Wednesday, Stanton came up with a bold idea that required the President's approval. Unwilling to waste the remainder of the night, Stanton dispatched messengers to bring Lincoln, Halleck, Seward, and Chase to a secret meeting in his office. Chase had just retired for the night when the courier rang his bell. "The Secretary of War desires that you come to the department immediately and has sent a carriage for you," he announced. Chase hastily rose and dressed, terrified that the enemy had captured Rosecrans and his entire army. John Hay was sent to the soldiers' home to summon Lincoln, who, like Chase, was already in bed. As Lincoln rose to dress, he was considerably disturbed, saying that it was the first time Stanton had ever sent for him. Guided by the light of the moon, Lincoln and Hay then rode back to the War Department. When the five men were assembled around the table, the austere Stanton said, I have invited this meeting because I am thoroughly convinced that something must be done, and done immediately." He proceeded to outline an audacious proposal to remove 20,000 men from General Meade's Army of the Potomac to Nashville and Chattanooga under General Hooker's command. The plan struck both Halleck and Lincoln as dangerous and impractical. Halleck protested that it would take at least 40 days to reach Tennessee. The troops would arrive too late, and Meade would be left vulnerable on the Rappahannock. The president agreed. "Why," he quipped, "you can't get one corps into Washington in the time you fix for reaching Nashville." A humorous anecdote he employed to illustrate his point greatly annoyed Stanton, who remarked that the danger was too imminent and the occasion too serious for jokes. He said that he had fully considered the question of practicability and should not have submitted his proposition had he not fully satisfied himself as to its feasibility. After further discussion, Chase suggested taking a break for the refreshments Stanton had prepared. On returning, Chase recalled, Mr. Seward took up the subject and supported Mr. Stanton's proposition with excellent arguments. Chase believed that Seward's support for the proposal was instrumental. Sensing his advantage, Stanton immediately sent an orderly to find Colonel D.C. McCallum, director of the Department of Military Railroads. Stanton had briefed McCallum earlier in the evening and directed him to prepare an estimate of the time necessary to transfer the troops by rail if all available trains were put at his disposal. When McCallum entered, Lincoln described the proposition and asked him to estimate how long it would take to achieve the goal. Without disclosing that he had received prior notice to consider the matter, McCallum asked for a moment to make a few figures. Seated at a desk with timetables spread before him, he worked for some time while the room remained silent. Finally, he stood up and said, "I can complete it in 7 days." "Good," Stanton exclaimed, turning contemptuously to Halleck. "I told you so. I knew it could be done. 40 days, 40 days indeed, when the life of the nation is at stake." He then addressed McCallum. "Go ahead. Begin now." At this point, Lincoln interrupted. "I have not yet given my consent," he reminded the Secretary of War. "Colonel McCallum, are you sure about this?" Lincoln asked. "There must be no mistake." When McCallum said he would pledge his life to accomplish it inside of 7 days, Lincoln was satisfied. "Mr. Secretary, you are the captain. Give the necessary orders, and I will approve them." Relentlessly, Stanton worked for more than 48 hours straight, commandeering trains for military use, telegraphing railroad managers along the route, determining the various gauges of the tracks. He acquired the provisions necessary for soldiers and horses to travel straight across the Alleghenies into East Tennessee without a stop to resupply. The first train left Washington at 5 p.m. on September 25th, with departures every hour until 23,000 men and 1,100 horses, 9 batteries, and hundreds of wagons, tents, and supplies arrived in Tennessee, ready to join Rosecrans in defense of Chattanooga. Monitoring reports from every station along the way, Stanton refused to go home. When exhaustion overtook him, he would collapse on his couch for a few hours, a cologne-moistened handkerchief tied around his forehead. Only when it became clear that the movement would succeed within the promised 7 days did he agree to leave his post. "It was an extraordinary feat of logistics," James McPherson writes, "the longest and fastest movement of such a large body of troops before the 20th century." The immediate peril was past, but Dana's reports in the following weeks indicated that the rebels had cut off supply routes into Chattanooga and that the troops had lost confidence in Rosecrans. Lincoln and Stanton decided that the time had come for a change in command. Stanton telegraphed Grant to leave Cairo, Illinois, for Louisville, Kentucky, where he would meet an officer of the War Department and receive new instructions. When Grant reached Indianapolis, he discovered that the War Department officer was Stanton himself. This was the first meeting between the two men. Stanton presented Grant with a choice between two orders. Both offered him command of a new military division of the Mississippi, encompassing the departments of the Cumberland, the Ohio, and the Tennessee. The first left the departmental commanders in place. Grant chose the second order, which replaced Rosecrans with Thomas. Stanton spent a day with Grant discussing the overall military situation before the general departed for Chattanooga. There, under his leadership, the Federals eventually drove the rebels from Tennessee after a stunning victory at Lookout Mountain. In his memoirs, Grant credits Stanton for playing an important role in saving Chattanooga. The unprecedented troop movement prevented a retreat that, Grant acknowledged, would have been a terrible disaster. Chase, too, lauded Stanton. "The country does not know how much it owes Edwin M. Stanton for that night's work." It was this indomitable drive that Lincoln had sought when he put aside any resentment at the humiliation Stanton had inflicted years earlier in Cincinnati. The bluntness and single-minded intensity behind Stanton's brusque dismissal of Lincoln at that first acquaintance were the qualities the president valued in his Secretary of War, whom he would affectionately call his Mars. Those who observed the improbable pair in the little room adjoining the telegraph office noted the esteem and affection that characterized their relationship. "It was an interesting and a pleasant sight," Clerk Charles Benjamin recalled, "that of Mr. Lincoln seated with one long leg crossed upon the other, his head a little peaked and his face lit up by the animation of talking or listening, while Mr. Stanton would stand sidewise to him, with one hand resting lightly on the high back of the chair in the brief intervals of that everlasting occupation of wiping his spectacles." Should Lincoln rise from the writing desk that Stanton arranged for him, the picturesqueness of the scene would give way to laughter, for the striking differences in height and girth at once suggested the two gendarmes in the French comic opera. "No two men were ever more utterly and irreconcilably unalike," Stanton's private secretary, A.E. Johnson, observed. The secretiveness which Lincoln wholly lacked, Stanton had in marked degree. The charity which Stanton could not feel coursed from every pore in Lincoln. Lincoln was for giving a wayward subordinate 70 times 7 chances to repair his errors. Stanton was for either forcing him to obey or cutting off his head without more ado. Lincoln was as calm and unruffled as the summer sea in moments of the gravest peril. Stanton would lash himself into a fury over the same condition of things. Stanton would take hardships with a groan. Lincoln would find a funny story to fit them. Stanton was all dignity and sternness, Lincoln all simplicity and good nature. Yet no two men ever did or could work better in harness. They supplemented each other's nature, and they fully recognized the fact that they were a necessity to each other. Johnson believed that, in dealing with the public, Lincoln's heart was greater than his head, while Stanton's head was greater than his heart. The antithetical styles are typified in the story of a congressman who had received Lincoln's authorization for the War Department's aid in a project. When Stanton refused to honor the order, the disappointed petitioner returned to Lincoln, telling him that Stanton had not only countermanded the order, but had called the president a damned fool for issuing it. "Did Stanton say I was a dashed fool?" Lincoln asked. "He did, sir," the congressman replied, "and repeated it." Smiling, the president remarked, "If Stanton said I was a dashed fool, then I must be one, for he is nearly always right, and generally says what he means. I will step over and see him." as Stanton came to know and understand Lincoln, his initial disdain turned to admiration. When George Harding, his old partner in the Reaper trial, assumed that Stanton was the author of the remarkable passages in one of Lincoln's messages, Stanton set him straight. "Lincoln wrote it, every word of it, and he is capable of more than that. Harding, no men were ever so deceived as we at Cincinnati." Few war ministers have had such real personal affection and respect for their king or president as Mr. Stanton had for Mr. Lincoln, a contemporary observed. Both had suffered great personal losses, and both were haunted all their days by thoughts of mortality and death. When Stanton was 18, a cholera epidemic had spread through the Midwest. Victims were buried as quickly as possible in an effort to contain the plague. Learning that a young friend had been buried within hours of falling ill, Stanton panicked, fearing that she had been buried alive while in a faint. He raced to the grave, where, with the help of a medical student friend, he exhumed her body to determine if she was truly dead. Contact with the body led to his own infection and near death from cholera. When his beloved wife, Mary, died 10 years later, he insisted on including her wedding ring, valuable pieces of her jewelry, and some of his correspondence in her casket. He spent hours at her gravesite, and when he could not be there, he sent an employee to stand guard. That Lincoln was also preoccupied with death is clear from the themes of many of his favorite poems that addressed the ephemeral nature of life and reflected his own painful acquaintance with death. He particularly cherished Mortality by William Knox and transcribed a copy for the Stantons. "Oh, why should the spirit of mortal be proud? Like a swift-fleeting meteor, a fast-flying cloud, a flash of lightning, a break of the wave, he passeth from life to his rest in the grave." He could recite from memory The Last Leaf by Oliver Wendell Holmes, and once claimed to the painter Francis Carpenter that, "For pure pathos, there was nothing finer in the English language than the six-line stanza, 'The mossy marbles rest on lips that he has pressed in their bloom, and the names he loved to hear have been carved for many a year on the tomb.'" Yet beyond sharing a romantic and philosophical preoccupation with death, the Commander-in-Chief and the Secretary of War shared the harrowing knowledge that their choices resulted in sending hundreds of thousands of young men to their graves. Stanton's Quaker background made the strain particularly unbearable. As a young man, he had written a passionate essay decrying society's exaltation of war. "Why is it," he asked, "that military generals are praised and honored instead of being punished as malefactors? After all, the work of war is the making of widows and orphans, the plundering of towns and villages, the exterminating and spoiling of all, making the earth a slaughterhouse. Though governments might argue war's necessity to achieve certain objectives, how much better might they accomplish their ends by some other means? But if generals are useful, so are butchers. And who will say that because a butcher is useful, he should be honored?" 3 decades after writing this, Stanton found himself responsible for an army of more than 2 million men. "There could be no greater madness," he reasoned, "than for a man to encounter what I do, for anything less than motives that overleap time and look forward to eternity." Lincoln, too, found the horrific scope of the burden hard to fathom. "Doesn't it strike you as queer that I, who couldn't cut the head off of a chicken, and who was sick at the sight of blood, should be cast into the middle of a great war, with blood flowing all about me?" Like Stanton, the president tried to console himself that the Civil War, however terrible, represented a divine will at work in human affairs. The previous year he had granted an audience to a group of Quakers, including Eliza Gurney. "If I had had my way," he reportedly said during the meeting, "this war would never have been commenced. If I had been allowed my way, this war would have been ended before this. But we find it still continues, and we must believe that he permits it, for some wise purpose of his own, mysterious and unknown to us. And though with our limited understandings we may not be able to comprehend it, yet we cannot but believe that he who made the world still governs it." He understood the terrible conflict suffered by the Friends, he wrote Mrs. Gurney later. "On principle and faith, opposed to both war and oppression, they can only practically oppose oppression by war. Their support and their prayers, even as they endured their own very great trial, would never be forgotten. Meanwhile," he continued, "we must work earnestly, in the best light he gives us, trusting that so working still conduces to the great ends he ordains. Surely he intends some great good to follow this mighty convulsion, which no mortal could make and no mortal could stay." As the friendship between Stanton and Lincoln deepened, Chase, who had been Stanton's most intimate companion, was increasingly marginalized. Chase maintained a warm relationship with the Secretary of War, however. Stanton still wrote affectionate notes to him. "I return your knife, which by some means found its way into my pocket," Stanton had written Chase the previous winter. "Let me add that if you love me like I love you, no knife can cut our love in two." A year later, Stanton would ask Chase to stand as godfather to his newborn child. Nevertheless, the balance of power between the two men had shifted. Stanton was now a happily married man with four children. The overworked Secretary of War no longer begrudged the lack of time Chase was able to spend with him. On the contrary, it was Chase who now had to pay court to Stanton. Deprived of access to vital military decisions, Chase was forced to rely on the War Secretary for the latest intelligence. Stanton had once yearned to spend entire evenings in Chase's study. Now, Chase was lucky to obtain a private conversation with his old friend when he joined the crowd that gathered in the telegraph office at the end of the working day. "It is painful for one to be so near the springs of action and yet unable to touch them," Chase admitted to an acquaintance. "It is almost like the nightmare in oppressiveness, and worse, because there is no illusion. I can only counsel, and that without any certainty of being understood, or, if understood, of being able to obtain concurrence, or even after concurrence, action." Chase's frustration with his position was alleviated only by his dreams of future glory, by his dogged hope that he, rather than Lincoln, would be the Republican nominee in 1864. In an era when single-term presidencies were the rule, he believed that if he could outflank Lincoln on Reconstruction, an issue most dear to radical Republicans, he could capture the nomination. The recent victories at Gettysburg and Vicksburg had created an illusion in the North that the end of the war was at hand. Questions of how the rebel states should be brought back into the Union began to dominate discussions in the halls of Congress, at dinner parties, in newspaper editorials, and in the smoke-filled bar of the Willard Hotel. The issue divided the Republican Party. Radicals insisted that only those who had never displayed even indirect support for the Confederacy should be allowed to vote in the redeemed states. Lawyers and teachers who had not been staunch unionists should not be allowed to resume their professions. Slavery should be immediately abolished without compensation, and newly freed blacks should be allowed to vote in some cases. Conservative Republicans preferred compensated emancipation and a lenient definition of who should gain suffrage. They argued that in every southern state, a silent majority of non-slaveholders had been dragged into secession by the wealthy plantation owners. It would be unjust to exclude them in the new order, so long as they would take an oath to uphold both the Union and emancipation. It was assumed in political circles that Lincoln would be the standard-bearer for the conservatives, while Chase would be the champion of the radicals. The state elections in the fall would presumably serve as the opening round of the presidential race. It was expected that Chase would aggressively promote the candidacies of fellow radicals, who in turn would be indebted to him the following year. While Chase's desire for the presidency was no less worthy a pursuit than Lincoln's, Noah Brooks observed, Chase's decision to pursue that ambition from within the president's cabinet, rather than resign his seat and openly proclaim his campaign, struck many as disingenuous. Chase's strategy was to approach potential supporters without expressly acknowledging that he would run. Late at night in his study, he wrote hundreds of letters to local officials, congressional leaders, generals, and journalists, citing the failures of the Lincoln administration. "I should fear nothing," he wrote the editor of the Cincinnati Gazette, "if we had an administration, in the first sense of the word, guided by a bold, resolute, far-seeing, and active mind, guided by an honest, earnest heart. But this we have not. Oh, for energy and economy in the management of the war!" A similar style prevailed in all of his letters. After detailing the flaws in Lincoln's leadership, Chase would suggest the differences that would characterize his own presidency. He denied that he coveted the position, but said he would accept the burden if pressed by his countrymen. "If I were myself controlled merely by personal sentiments, I should prefer the re-election of Mr. Lincoln," Chase explained. "But I think that a man of different qualities from those the president has will be needed for the next 4 years. I am not anxious to be regarded as that man, but I am quite willing to refer that question to the decision of those who agree in thinking that some such man should be had." As in 1860, Chase took great pains to cultivate the press, not recognizing that it was too early to extract binding commitments. He was thrilled by Horace Greeley's letter in late September, telling him that he knew no one better qualified for president than yourself, nor one whom I should more cordially support. Chase apparently discounted Greeley's closing caveat that in 6 months, events might dictate the need to concentrate on another candidate. Similarly, while Chase elicited assurance from Hiram Barney, the head of the New York Custom House, that he was his first choice for the presidency, Barney insisted on deciding only when the time came, whether yourself, the president, or some other person should receive it. Lincoln was fully aware of what Chase was doing. Governor Dennison alerted him that Chase was working like a beaver, and Seward cautioned that several organizations were fixing to control delegate appointments for Mr. Chase. Ohio Congressman Samuel Cox warned the White House that Chase had tied up nearly the whole strength of the New England states. A Pennsylvanian politician informed the White House that Chase had so ardently campaigned for his support that he could see the presidency glaring out of both eyes. John Hay learned that Chase had called on the New York journalist Theodore Tilton, working all a summer's day to maneuver the influential Independent to his side. Whereas Lincoln's loyal young secretary was disturbed by Chase's mad hunt after the presidency, Lincoln was amused. Chase's incessant presidential ambitions reminded him of the time when he was plowing corn on a Kentucky farm with a lazy horse that suddenly sped forward energetically to the end of the furrow. Upon reaching the horse, he discovered an enormous chin fly fastened upon him and knocked him off, not wanting the old horse bitten in that way. His companion said that it was a mistake to knock it off, for That's all that made him go. Now, Lincoln concluded, if Mr. Chase has a presidential chin fly biting him, I'm not going to knock him off, if it will only make his department go. Lincoln agreed that his secretary's tactics were in very bad taste, and was sorry the thing had begun, for though the matter did not annoy him, his friends insisted that it ought to. Lincoln's friends could not understand why the president continued to approve appointments for avid Chase supporters who were known to be hostile to the president's interests. Lincoln merely asserted that he would rather let Chase have his own way in these sneaking tricks than getting into a snarl with him by refusing him what he asks. Moreover, he had no thought of dismissing Chase while he was hard at work raising the resources needed to support the immense Union army. Lincoln's response to Chase was neither artless nor naive. His old friend Leonard Swett maintained that there never was a greater mistake than the impression that Lincoln was a frank, guileless, unsophisticated man. In fact, he handled and moved man remotely, as we do pieces upon a chessboard. Nor did Lincoln's posture toward Chase imply a tepid desire for a second term. Swett was correct in supposing that Lincoln was much more eager for it than he was for the first one. The Union, emancipation, his reputation, his honor, and his legacy all depended on the outcome of the ongoing war. But he recognized it was safer to keep Chase as a dubious ally within the administration rather than to cut him loose to mount a full-blown campaign. Meanwhile, so long as Chase remained in the cabinet, Lincoln insisted on treating him with respect and dignity. That Chase was disconcerted by Lincoln's warmth is evident in a letter he wrote to James Watson Webb, the former editor who was now the American minister to Brazil. After criticizing Lincoln's disjointed method of administration and admitting that he had been often tempted to retire, Chase acknowledged that the president has always treated me with such personal kindness and has always manifested such fairness and integrity of purpose that I have not found myself free to throw up my trust. So I still work on. Lincoln told a worried Hay that he had all along clearly seen Chase's plan of strengthening himself. Whenever he sees that an important matter is troubling me, if I am compelled to decide it in a way to give offense to a man of some influence, he always ranges himself in opposition to me and persuades the victim that he has been hardly dealt by and that he, C, would have arranged it very differently. It was so with General Fremont, with General Hunter when I annulled his hasty proclamation, with General Butler when he was recalled from New Orleans.